Hello and welcome to the Jacobite Podcast, episode 14, The Rising of the 15. Britain once again found itself in rebellion as of the end of 1715. Mar and Forster rallied their troops in the north and prepared to make their move. Their only quandary once they'd raised this army was where to head first. This led to another issue in the Jacobite forces, which was the many differences of opinion between Scottish Jacobites and their English counterparts. As we discussed before, whilst the overall aim of the Jacobites was the restoration of the House of Stuart, there was also a large contingent of Scots who felt the best way to dissolve the Act of Union with England and restore Scottish independence was to restore King James to his throne at Holyrood. The English Jacobites were not as enthused about liberating Scotland and wished to settle on taking England first. And so it was that when the Scots suggested taking Dumfries, Ayr and Glasgow so that the few Hanoverian troops from the Campbell lands under the Duke of Argyll would be forced to be divided between north and south, the English weren't keen. They didn't want to go all the way to Scotland. Another plan was to launch a preemptive strike against General George Carpenter, who'd been ordered to go north to confront the rebels. That was scrapped because Forster, the English Jacobite commander, was reluctant to engage Carpenter, even though the forces the government had were weakened by the peace between England and France, and therefore Carpenter had had to field a understrength regiment. Eventually, Lancastrian Jacobites were persuaded to offer supplies and support to the army, who now, all bar 500 Scots who refused to leave their homeland, had decided to march through the north of England. They passed through with no real opposition from the populace. They went through Penrith, Kendal and Lancaster through October and November 1715. There weren't many local recruits for the army, save some Catholic Englishmen who volunteered to restore James, but very few local Tories joined the Jacobites, and the Catholics that joined the army began to irk the Scottish Presbyterians, who were nervous and wanted to have more of the establishment Tories and Anglicans within their ranks. Eventually, Forster's men made their way to Preston, a market town of around 6,000. It was here that the Jacobites raised their standard in the marketplace and with great pomp and fanfare declared James Francis Edward Stuart King on November 10th, 1715. The government, however, was not taking things lying down. Despite Preston having been taken without a battle, General Charles Wills, commander of the forces in Cheshire, was advancing on the town. The first government troops were spotted approaching the Ribble Bridge from Wigan. For inexplicable reasons, Forster never took the numerous reports of government advances seriously, or if he did, he didn't seem to act on the reports to provide any defence. In fact, when troops were spotted, Forster ordered John Farquharson of Invercold and his forces to withdraw to perceived safety in the city. This has been argued by some as a tactical mistake by historians, and it's easy to see why. Like William Wallace years before, the Williamites in Ireland, even, the Jacobite rebels could have created a choke point through the bridge with which to force government troops and pick them off. But instead, in retreat, the Jacobites left the road to Preston wide open to the government. They erected barricades on the streets under the command of William McIntosh of Borlam. Given his advanced years of already being in his 60s, Old Borlam, as he was known, set up the barricades to slow the government advance, drawing them to kill zones on the outskirts. Borlam was extremely keen to avoid a pitched battle with Hanoverian forces, given that he felt their armies numbered greater amounts of horse and cannon. Borlam was also somewhat contemptuous of the forces under his command. These men were poorly trained and poorly armed, some of whom had nothing more than pitchforks. The Scots and the English would dress differently, from full Highland dress to just white cockades for the English. Borlam was less than impressed and is said to have collared Forster, stating, and I apologise now for my terrible Scots accent, "Look ye there, Forster, are yon fellow the men ye intend to fight wells with? Good faith, sir, and ye had 10,000 of them, I'd fight them with 1,000 of his dragoons." Sorry again. Some Jacobites were contemptuous of the High Churchmen, whom Jacobite chaplain Robert Patton noted didn't care for venturing their carcasses any further than the tavern. Borlum's plans stationed these four barricade zones around Preston, with reserve men kept in the marketplace, ready to move as a rapid response on the barricades for the government side attack. General Wills came to the Ribble Bridge and was probably as surprised as anyone else to find it undefended. He therefore proposed a pincer movement, striking the roads to Wigan and Lancaster, cutting off the rebel escape. The government troops were inexperienced, raw recruits, and numerically similar to the Jacobites, but at least they had basic arms and training. Their aim, once they'd cut off the retreat, was to set fire to the houses and neutralise any rebel threat. At 2 p.m. on November 12th, 1715, the government commenced their attack. Brigadier Honeywood, for the government, attacked the barricades commanded by McIntosh. The government commanders felt this would be a walkover, and that the Highland troops would flee at the sign of the army. Unfortunately for General Wills, the Jacobite troops quickly and brutally disabused them of that notion by giving a spirited resistance. 120 government troops were lost in roughly 10 minutes as Honeywood's men retreated to the safety of the outskirts of Preston under withering fire from the Jacobite battery. Some troops of Wills tried to reach the square in the centre, but they were ineffectual. The government attacked the men of Lord Charles Murray and Earl Derwentwater. Despite my prior snarkiness, the self-proclaimed General Derwentwater acquitted himself well, as did Lord Charles Murray, son of the Duke of Athol. Their barricades repulsed the government troops, who at this point sheltered within two properties that formerly belonged to Sir Henry Houghton and Mr. Ayres. Houghton's house had fantastic panoramic views of the city. Strangely, the Jacobites had already occupied this house at some point during the day, but had been moved away from it. Some have said it was McIntosh and some have said Forster, but the truth is we never quite know, but everyone agrees that it was a major error. This error was realised by Murray and Derwentwater, who requested Cannon to demolish the house. But Thomas Forster, who'd retreated to his bed with puddings, sweets and drink, refused, expressing his eagerness to keep the town of Preston to preserve the army. Not only does this help exemplify that Forster didn't understand the importance of taking shelter from an enemy, but that the government now had the high ground. And despite having a sweet-eating inebriate as their commander, the Jacobites tried to dislodge the Hanoverians to no avail. Night began to fall and the attacks lessened. One slightly ridiculous government error was General Wills ordering lights lit in houses under government possession. This simply gave the Jacobites a nicely lit target. The lights were eventually extinguished, but it was an episode that helped to highlight just how ridiculously inept commanders on both sides were in this particular battle. Despite the setbacks and the surrender of the high ground, McIntosh felt he was in a good position to push the government forces in the next morning out of their positions and to retain Preston. This belief, however, suffered a rude awakening on the morning of November 13th, as General Carpenter brought backup for Wills in the shape of three regiments of dragoons. He'd rushed from Newcastle, but when he arrived in Preston, he quickly shook things up and reformed the men into a complete encirclement. Most of the Highlanders, and several others, were ready to fight in a death or glory charge, but Forster and his officers had decided that further bloodshed would be pointless. Forster ordered negotiations for surrender be conducted with Wills. Unfortunately for the Jacobites, Wills argued he couldn't make terms with rebels and that all of Forster's men would have to throw themselves upon the mercy of King George. Some still attempted to escape and around half a dozen soldiers were killed by government forces. The Earl of Derwentwater and Brigadier McIntosh were held as hostages and, despite the efforts of one of the soldiers who attempted to assassinate Forster by shooting him, the Jacobites accepted the terms of surrender. On November 14th, 1715, the marketplace of Preston was full of victorious government troops and rebels surrendering arms and being imprisoned. The rebel lords were held at inns and private lodgings, while the rest were held in the local church and held for a month with the townspeople under orders to feed the prisoners, which no doubt added to some antipathy to the government for these orders and to the Jacobites for putting them through it in the first place. And thus ended the last battle on English soil. An extraordinary set of circumstances led to what one Jacobite called the first instance of a victorious army after action yielding themselves prisoner to the vanquished. This, though, could be seen as an overstatement of how much success the Jacobites may have had. Nearly 300 government troops were killed and far fewer Jacobites, but with men like Forster in charge, they were never going to be able to be an effective challenge, and he had no idea what he was doing and no way to rally popular support. The English never really came out for James and his supporters, but that's not to say they supported the Hanoverians. Speaking of which, their commanders were ill-equipped and poorly trained to take on the rebels and seriously underestimated their fighting spirit. General Wills seemed to think they'd be a walkover, and he wasn't ready to have a long and vicious firefight against an enemy. Professor Daniel Szczecki, and I'm sorry if I got your name wrong, if anyone can correct me for the pronunciation, has argued that had the Jacobite forces managed to capitalise on the mistakes Wells made, then they could have defended Preston and tried to help elsewhere with the rising. The fact that Jacobite command was more inept than the government was frankly just luck. To the north, in Scotland, things had gone better in the initial stages. Despite a covert operation to seize Edinburgh Castle and its huge arms cache failing, the Earl of Mar's men numbered nearly 20,000, and they'd seized Aberdeen, Dundee, the Firth of Forth, the gateway to the Highlands in Perth, and the city known as the Highland Capital, Inverness. Mar was confident his forces could overwhelm Argyll's and take Stirling Castle, the almost impregnable fortress straddling the Highlands and Lowlands. As Mar's forces marched west from Perth to Stirling, the Duke of Argyll rallied his forces, still unsure he had enough men to defend Scotland, and made to intercept Mar. Mar obviously had felt he could afford to wait, and wanted his king, James III and VIII, to arrive to reward him. But James was stuck in France awaiting ships, and Mar decided to spend his time at this point raiding the area for supplies, levying taxes, or cess as it's otherwise known in the records, and badgering the infamous outlaw Rob Roy MacGregor to join him as promised. Rob Roy had appeared supportive of the Jacobite cause, but was probably in all likelihood hedging his bets like a lot of other people. This delaying and dallying by Mar really helped Argyll tremendously, as some reinforcements had arrived to bolster the government numbers. At the same time as Preston was happening, Mar lined his men facing the government forces with the Wherry Burn, a small stream, to his left, with the Marquess of Tullibardine and his atoll men, the Earl of Seaforth, the Mackenzies, and a front line of Clan Gordon. Facing them, Argyll drew his men in a line. They were almost outnumbered 2-1, but here they were, ready to resist the Jacobites and defend the Hanoverian regime. The Battle of Sheriffmuir, as it became known, started at noon on November 13th, 1715, when Argyll's men fired a volley of rifle fire, which all bar one of the Jacobites, Elian Yerg of Clan Ranald, whose death spurred the rebel troops into a full-bore Highland charge, which terrified the government's left flank, whose commander, General Wetham, rode to Stirling proclaiming the day was lost. Argyll's centre managed to link up with the Duke's right flank, shortly before General Whiteman himself had felt his troops would have been overrun. But it was not a good day to be part of the government forces, as the Highland charge from the Jacobites had once again proved its effectiveness in both physical and psychological terms. Argyll's counterattack was to send his dragoons against Mar's left flank, which hadn't got ready yet, sending horses in against foot soldiers who broke and fled. Lord Strathmore, for the Jacobites, tried to rally his troops and grab the regimental colours, but he was wounded and cut down when taken prisoner. Argyll wanted to do more and press his advantage here, but the government left was destroyed, as well as the fact that the numbers were against him. Therefore, Argyll and Whiteman regrouped, waiting for the attack that was sure to come. But the Jacobite attack never came. Mar called his officers together, and with his men tired and hungry, had decided to retire to Perth to consider his options. Thanks were given in church sermons to God, and he celebrated the victory by writing to the governor of Perth that he'd won against the usurper's forces. But in reality, the Jacobites had begun to be hit with numerous desertions. Some of the usual people who would desert around about winter time as the campaign season began to wind down, but many of the others felt that the government had not been given the knockout blow at Sheriffmuir they felt it needed, and so they were seeking to put as much distance between themselves and the Jacobites when the inevitable government reprisals started. The Battle of Sheriffmuir had all in all been an inconclusive affair. Neither side had won, but neither could say they'd lost. Some have argued nobody won, because Argyll lost nearly 20% of his forces, and Mar couldn't defeat a numerically inferior force. Proclamations were issued by Jacobite commanders, notably the Marquess of Tullibardine, to try and hold the line and stem the hemorrhaging of troops, but then news hit them from Inverness that sank their ambitions. Inverness had been under the control of the Mackenzies and Macdonalds of Keppoch, but the government received a boost when the Hanoverian cause was aided by Simon Fraser, the 11th Lord Lovat. Now, the more observant amongst you will remember that the last time we met him, he was in fact a Jacobite. But with all that time spent imprisoned in France for his wheeling and dealing over the plot against Atholl, Simon's enthusiasm for the old cause had waned a bit. So when one of his own clan, James Fraser of Castle Leathers, and for the Outlander fans, I'm sorry to report, no, it's not that James Fraser, arrived to tell Simon that his clan needed him, he snuck back to Scotland in 1714 and decided to hide until he could see if the authorities were going to hunt him down for everything he'd done previously. But Simon's luck was in, as not only had the government been more focused on the struggle to put the House of Hanover on the throne, but both the Mackenzies and the Murrays, his mortal enemies, were tainted by their part in the Jacobite Rising. Simon therefore presented himself and his clan Fraser of Lovat men to the Duke of Argyll as the government's men in the north. Lovat teamed up with the Forbes of Culloden, the Roses, the Munros and the Grants, and laid siege to Inverness, opposite the castle in the city centre. The local Jacobite sympathising council sent requests to the local Clan MacDonald and Clan MacIntosh, but Lovat neutralised them, with diplomacy to the MacDonalds, who didn't wish to fight their way to Inverness. To the MacIntoshes, on the other hand, he threatened to lay waste to their lands until they eventually backed down. Lovat then decided, against the advice of all of his other lairds, to launch an assault to retake Inverness, but ended up being preempted by Arthur Rose, the younger son of the chief of Clan Rose, who rowed across by boat and tried with some allies to seize the Tolbooth building. But the defenders got wind of them coming, and Rose had tried to storm in but was trapped by a door with a guard who raised the alarm and ended up being riddled with bullets. Sad as it was, Arthur Rose was to be the only fatality of the siege. Sir John Mackenzie, head of the Jacobite forces in Inverness, immediately offered terms to Lovat on the condition that he and his men be allowed to join the Earl of Mar and the rest of the Jacobite forces in Perth. Lovat and the government forces entered Inverness on the 12th of November 1715, thereby taking control of the major city and port in the Highlands. The Jacobite commanders had fled before Lovat's arrival. Coming in with Lovat was Robert Munro, the man appointed by King George as governor of Inverness. Lovat may not have been put in charge, but he'd made his mark with King George's government. This was the beginning of the ascendancy of Simon Fraser and his alliance with the House of Hanover. He'd not only got one over on his old rival Atholl, but he'd also managed to show that he was with the Hanoverians, and he was a powerful ally to have. So we've seen the Jacobites rally their troops, fight two battles that they didn't win, then lose Inverness and most of their support in England. Mar could see the campaign was not going the way the Jacobites and James would have wanted, and so he wrote to his king in Lorraine and told him not to come. So of course it would be awful if that letter didn't make it in time, which is of course exactly what happened, and next time we will see the arrival of the King Over the Water, King James III and VIII, or James Francis Edward Stuart, or the Old Pretender, delete whichever of these you find is applicable, as he sets foot in his kingdoms for the first time in over 20 years. I say next time because this is going to be the final podcast of 2020, as I'm going to take a break over the holidays to rest, recuperate, write the next script, and spend some time with Mrs. Jacobite Podcast. So from me here, a Merry Christmas, a Happy New Year, a goodbye to 2020, and I will see you all again in January 2021 when we pick up the next part of the Jacobite Podcast. Bye for now.